And we're back in the house. What's up, Nick?
This is our second one. We've lasted this long. This is doing all right, isn't it?
Yeah. What, like, it's an achievement not falling at the first hurdle?
I've just been given dinner, so I'm a happy man.
Ah, what did you have?
Oh, Jodie, your wonderful partner's signature dish, even a bit of kale in there.
No seaweed, though. Did you know that all British seaweed is edible?
All?
All British seaweed is edible.
When we were waiting, we were swimming the other day, and we were waiting for one of our mates, and it was freezing, and just to stay warm, I pulled over a load of seaweed over me. It didn't keep me warm, and I don't think, I was quite hungry at the time as well. I don't think I fancied that. It didn't seem that was an edible type.
We didn't cook it.
Do you cook it?
Well, if you cook it, it's a bit nicer, isn't it, than just eating it raw.
Only ever had it in the Chinese.
Got a swim tomorrow morning coming up.
Yeah, it's really cold at the moment. The last few swims have been freezing, like teeth cold freezing. I luckily dodged last week the coldest swim of the year. You and Tom went.
Yeah, so it was apparently the night before we went swimming was the coldest night on record since, I don't know, 2019 or 2016 or something like that. Anyway, so it was bloody knobbling and it was icy and I can't remember what we did, but yeah, it got out real cold. Oh, yeah. So we did Penarth to Lavernock, but we started the far end. So we went around Penarth Pier and then down to Lavernock Point. So it was kind of the long route of that swim, but we also didn't have much of a push. So we sort of timed it like just on the turn of the tide or sort of just before. So normally you've got like wings behind you and a big tidal push, but we didn't have that. So I think I was in the water about 10 minutes into like a what turned out to be about a 50-minute swim, and I was already cold in about 10 minutes.
It was comedy that morning because I was going to work, and that wasn't the comedy bit, but just completely de-iced my car, went in the house, it had already frozen again. I was just thinking, oh, I'm glad I'm not swimming today.
Yeah, I've got two vehicles, one the sort of heating works and the other it doesn't. So
what did you go for then?
I went for the heated version.
Oh, good choice.
So Nick, can you imagine swimming for like 16 hours from one piece of land to another, having to eat, go to the toilet, everything en route? You can't get in a boat, and all of the training and preparation, like physically and mentally, that it takes to achieve that.
I can't, but I know a man who can. Today we are interviewing Tom Chapman. This man is an absolute channel swimming legend. He's a world record holder, head honcho at the Bristol Channel Swimming Association, and all-round good egg.
He laps up the distance swims for breakfast, doesn't he?
In budgies as well. It just blows my mind a bit how he does all that.
I'll make my excuses, all sorts of excuses for not wearing budgies when I swim.
I'll make my excuses to not swim with Tom whenever he's coming.
Yeah. So that's why we're interviewing him instead. Whenever we swim with him, he's a bit rapid, isn't he, sometimes?
Oh, God. And wants to be out for 11 hours at a time.
Yeah. I don't think he's discovered the snacks yet, has he? Like the joy of stopping and eating snacks, not just carbohydrates in liquid form.
It's the only point to swim, surely.
Yeah. The breakfast reviews, which I might add, we will be adding to this podcast soon. Breakfast reviews.
Oh, the floating buffet, the only point to swim, surely.
No, I'm thinking more a cafe afterwards.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely, yeah. Welcome. I'm Nick.
Croeso. I'm Bryce. You're listening to Swim Roots,
an open water swim podcast.
Okay, Tom, can you please introduce yourself?
Hello, Bryce. I'm a swimmer. I live in Liverpool. I swim in the Bristol Channel. What more do you want to know?
What an introduction. So, on a scale of 1 to 10, How excited are you about doing this podcast?
Oh, I love it. I've been waiting all week for it. It is only Monday.
Yeah, true. Is it the highlight of your week so far?
Oh, it definitely is. Definitely.
What do you do on a daily basis? What's work?
I'm a mechanical engineer. I work for a company in Cardiff that make industrial 3D printers.
You need to expand on that. I want to know about what things from these 3D printers, what do these 3D printers make?
So the printers that we make metal components, not the plastic ones that you normally get in an office, you know. So they're big industrial machines. Lays a very fine layer of metal powder down and then blast it with a freaking laser beam, melt it, put some more powder, more lasers, more powder, more lasers, and you build up whatever your little heart can dream up.
Any examples of what you guys built?
So there was a supersonic car a couple of years ago that they were trying to build. We built the steering wheel for that. They had a titanium steering wheel.
Wow.
A lot of medical components, a lot of aerospace stuff.
You're playing this down a little bit.
I know. Have you borrowed any for your bionic shoulders? Is this how it all started?
A bum propeller.
Tom, on your very rubbish own introduction, I feel that we need to introduce you a bit better because you're definitely doing yourself a bit of a disservice. I did notice on your dry robe you had world record holding badge. You had a badge for a world record holder, multiple Bristol Channel crossing swimmer, English Channel swimmer, Iron Man. Is there no end to your talent? Come on, give us a bit more of your introduction so people know who you are.
And he's a dog walker.
And I'm a dog walker, yeah, you must not forget that one. Okay, so, yeah, if I'm honest, I used to do triathlon 6, 7, 8 years ago. I think 2016 was the last one I did. After Ironman, I turned to just being a swimmer. A couple of English Channel relays, English Channel solo in 2019. And then turned my attentions a little bit closer to home. So last couple of years, I've done 6 different solos across the Bristol Channel, 4 different routes, I think now. And then after that, we set up the Bristol Channel Swimming Association. So Bristol Channel's always been traditionally a difficult one to get across because there were no pilots, there was no association. Recently, I'm talking sort of last 2-3 years, it's the popularity of the Bristol Channel has just gone through the roof. There's a couple of commercial pilots now. Last year, I think something like 20 people got across. So with an association there, with pilots there, it's almost opened it up now for the masses. To say 20 people a year, it's not really the masses, is it?
But it's on the map now, isn't it? And before, it wasn't really on the map. It was just a bit of a sort of dark kind of, yeah, a bit of a dark horse of the channel swimming kind of calendar, or not even on it, really, was it?
Yeah, so I mean, the English Channel, it's quite easy. There's 10 boats that can take you across, 2 associations. You essentially just phone one of them up, book a slot, pay a deposit, and you're off and running. Bristol Channel, the first swim was in the 1920s, but since then, there was only a handful of people that have got across. I'm talking sort of 20 people. And it's almost chicken and the egg, really, because there was no pilots to take people. There were no swimmers coming. And those that did get across, they were all sort of organizing their own swim with local fishing boats and things like that. And I don't think any of the boats or the pilots kind of saw the big picture, really, until the last few years when they've been getting an awful lot of phone calls of people going, oh, I've seen somebody swim the Bristol Channel. I've done the English Channel. I've done all these other swims. I want to do that one.
And now people are actually traveling here to do it specifically.
Yeah. So the last couple of years, we've had swimmers from all over the world, South America, North America, Australia. We had the first Costa Rican swimmer this year. Or last year, I should say, 2023. Swimmers from Spain, from...
Very cold for them, surely.
Yeah, I think it is. But we've had an awful lot of really top-class swimmers that have come from all over the world, and some of the swims that they've done, it's just phenomenal.
So before we get too much into the Bristol Channel, we're going to just rewind a little bit and talk about your journey before we kind of dive into the dark, silty, murky waters of the Severn Estuary and the Bristol Channel. When did you start swimming, Tom?
Is this where I have to admit that I was born in Birmingham and there was no sea? So as a kid, I did a lot of swimming, but it was mainly lifeguards. And obviously in Birmingham, it was pool lifeguards. So I did an awful lot of the life-saving awards up to kind of, you know, probably the age of 10 or 12 or something like that. I'd done all the little distance badges that you do as a kid. And then I kind of fell out of, I didn't fall out of love with swimming, but life just took me away from it a little bit, really. I didn't really get back into it, get back into triathlon until I was probably 30, maybe. Always one of those people that, you know, says, yeah, I can swim. And then you join a tri club and see people that can actually swim, and you're like, yeah, okay, perhaps I can't swim.
So what brought you back and attracted you back to the open waters, do you think, after Ironman?
Well, I never really wanted to finish Ironman. I kind of got injured, and I couldn't ride the bike and I couldn't run. And I was doing an awful lot of training at the time. Like every day I was out doing something. And the swimming, it just kind of filled the gap of the cycling and the running. So instead of doing, you know, 30% of your time on each, it was just 100% swimming. And the swims just got bigger and bigger and fell in with the wrong crowd. And one thing led to another.
So what injuries did you have?
I'm just going to say it was overuse. I think I was burnt out. My hip started to go wrong and that was putting pressure on my knee. And it was just painful, and I couldn't seem to get the right reply out of all the physios that I saw, trying loads of different things, but couldn't get back to it. I think looking back on it now, it was just overuse. It was just doing the same thing day after day after day, just smashing it without taking a proper break and without doing all the other good strength and conditioning things that you need to do, really, when you're putting that kind of mileage in.
Yeah, I've got a similar experience in having done a lot of trail running, and me and Nick used to run a lot together, and I think knees over time, you know, it took its toll on the knees, and then ended up with ACL surgery, having snapped my ACL playing basketball just because of maybe something I hadn't let heal properly. And swimming is really low impact, isn't it? Well, we say it's low impact, but on a lot of your body anyway.
I think the problems you get with swimming is every time you go out and you do, say, a 10K swim, you're putting probably 10,000 rotations on your shoulder. So if your technique's not quite right, you're putting a lot of load in places that perhaps it shouldn't be.
I love how the distance you went there. Every time you go out for a 10K swim, most people listen to this are going, no, never really go out and do a 10K swim.
Yeah, a lot of people aren't relating right now, Tom.
I've spoken to a lot of people about building their swimming up to some of these marathon swims, and I try and relate it back to running for them. And you get triathletes that are like, yeah, I'm going to go and swim the length of Windermere or whatever, which is 10 miles. And you kind of go, well, a 10K swim is pretty much the same as running a marathon. So now go back and look at your swim training, and you're doing a marathon on Monday, a half on Tuesday, another marathon on Wednesday. It's no wonder that your shoulders are starting to squeal a little bit, you know?
We're on a shared WhatsApp group, and we'd sort of note our distances. And then Tom was just dropping there, yeah, I've done like a 20K today. And you just, oh, way to crush a man's heart, let me tell you.
When we came and swam last year, wasn't it?
No, I remember it was not last year, a few years back, we did Penarth to Barry. And I was like organising this Penarth to Barry, and I'd spoken to you in a few days before it, and you were like, oh, I'm up for that. I was like, yeah, okay. So we rock up, and the day before, Tom did Penarth to Clevedon or Penarth to Weston. So you'd been swimming about 6.5 hours the day before, then you rocked up and did Penarth to Barry, which for those who don't know is about 10k. And it was about a two and a half, three quarters an hour swim, something like that. And you just rocked up the day after a marathon swim.
A nice little swim down from what I remember.
Yeah,
So when you start training for the English Channel, people always say, how do you train for a channel swim? And for an English Channel solo, you have to do a qualifier, which is 6 hours long in water that's less than 15 degrees. And that kind of, it's more about proving to yourself, really, that you can survive for that long in that kind of water. But the gold standard, really, is to do your 6 hour one day and a 7 hour the next day. And that's, you know, over 2 days, that's 13 hours of swimming, which is going to be somewhere close to your English Channel solo. And if you can do that, you know, you're onto a winner with your English Channel, really. So a 6 hour swim on whatever it was, Friday, and then a 2 hour swim the day after. That was a good training swim for me.
Almost 3 hours, actually, Tom.
3 hours, sorry.
And all these mega swims, just to reiterate, are in budgies. You are just doing it without wetsuits and... Oh, wow.
100%, yeah. So when I was a triathlete, never took my wetsuit off. Every time I swam in the pool, I was wearing neoprene shorts because, you know, triathlete, they make you go faster, your Strava looks better. when I signed up to the English Channel, the number one rule, there's only pretty much two rules to channel swimming. You touch the shore both sides, you don't touch the boat in between, and you wear budgies, that's it. And it's all to do with not gaining an advantage from floating higher in the water and being warmer. Channel swimming is kind of that raw man against Mother Nature, and that's it. There's no help, there's no support. You've got the boat next to you, but it really is just you and a pair of Speedos versus Mother Nature.
Merman and merwoman. I did have Zoolander in my head then when you said that. Merman. So this is actually leads us into a really good kind of conversation, actually. Can you explain to us what the ratification process is for channel swimming? Because you've just started to explain it. So for those who don't know much about channel swimming and channel swimming rules, can you just explain that a little bit more?
So, yeah, sure. So English Channel, it was first swum in 1875, I think, by a guy wearing a jazzy little woolen one piece and drinking, you know, Bovril and pints of beer off a boat that was next to him. Now, his swim, he started on the beach in Dover and he pretty much finished in Calais. No touching the boat, no sort of wetsuits, no extra warmth, no outside assistance. And the rules pretty much were set by that, the sort of rules for channel swimming. Pretty much the rules for all the different channels around the world. You know, there's channels in New Zealand and Japan, and you can go and swim the Gibraltar Straits if you want. You can swim between the islands in Hawaii. All of those basic rules are pretty much the same as they were in 1875. Pair of standard swimwear, which generally means budgie smugglers for a chap. One pair of goggles, one pair of hats. One swim hat. You can wear earplugs if you want, but other than that, pretty much everything else is against the rules. So you're not even allowed to wear a Garmin, for example, because it gives you a lot of information. You know, it tells you about your pacing, you can set it to tell you about nutrition, all that kind of thing. So that would be against the standard rules.
That's pretty full on, isn't it, for those who are used to wearing a wetsuit, me included.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, and so you can't touch the boat.
You're not allowed to touch the boat. You're not allowed to touch another person. So normally with channel swimming rules, you can have a support swimmer, but they're only allowed to swim for 1 hour at a time, and they're not allowed to swim in front of you, so you can't draft and gain an advantage. They're allowed to do an hour, and then they've got to get out. Food, you can stop as often as you want, and the boat is allowed to throw you whatever you want, you know, bottles of drink, dry food if you can figure out how to do it whilst you're in the water, treading water. But you need to remember, when you're in the open water, especially in the Bristol Channel, the tide plays such a big part of it. So if you're treading water for, say, 5 minutes, having a nice little picnic, you're probably going to have drifted half a mile up and down the channel, depending which way the tide's going, you know?
Yeah, you can see it on the Garmins, like on the tracks. When we've done like those sorts of swims, you can see where exactly where you've stopped, because the line all of a sudden just does a right angle for a short way and then you carry on. And there's some quite innovative ways to feed as well, aren't there? I mean, I remember having like a retractable dog lead, but people use kind of poles, don't they, with buckets on the end, like decorators' poles, and
they're allowed.
Yep.
Well, as long as I think the swimmer doesn't touch the boat, but they can take something out of like a plastic bucket hung off an extension pole.
You're not allowed to hang off it. You're not allowed to drag on it. Quite often, people will go with like a Tupperware pot or a drinks bottle on a rope, and then basically you can drift alongside the boat, and they can just reel it in afterwards. It all depends on the person. And everybody's nutrition strategy is completely different. I've seen a guy, or I've heard a story of a guy that did the English Channel solely on Egg McMuffins. So they stopped at the McDonald's in Dover and he bought something like 50 Egg McMuffins, got on the boat and swam the channel.
I'd swim the channel for that. Tell us a bit about your strategy then. Are you using the poles, the buckets? What's your bag?
So I tried to keep mine as simple as I can and with the most bang for your buck. So, you know, if you're swimming for 12 hours, say, well, even if you're swimming for 6 hours, you're constantly going to be burning more calories than you can physically take on. So you're kind of only going one way throughout the day. What I've done with my bottle is I kind of calculated how many calories is the sort of optimum amount that I can take on. How many sort of, what's the interval between my feeds? And I put exactly the same thing in every bottle and then try and feed every 45 minutes. So I've got pure carbohydrate and I've got Ribena and I've got the smallest amount of water that I can digest that with. Every 45 minutes, they throw me the bottle down as quickly as I can so I'm not getting pushed by the currents, throw them the bottle back and I'm on my way.
And what about solids? Do you have any sort of like, you know, because you mentioned you have your carbohydrates and your sort of fruit, dextrose and kind of fructose kind of mix. And I mean, that's bare bones. That's just literally what your body requires to keep going. But what about treats? That's what Nikki really is kind of edging towards.
So I always say you've got to have a plan B with your nutrition strategy. So every time I get on a boat to swim, I've got a box that's just stacked full of Pringles and chocolates and, you know, Jammy Dodgers and Jaffa Cakes. And so far, I don't think I've ever dabbed into that. I've just gone with the drink, the carbohydrate drink, all the way from start to finish. I don't know anybody else that has just done swims like these just on liquid, but it seems to work for me. And I think that's probably the triathlon background, you know, when we were sort of out on the bike for 5-6 hours training for Ironman, quite often you've just got a carbohydrate drink, so my body was pretty much used to just fueling on that.
I found actually, because before I did the Penarth Clevedon, I spoke to you about all this and I followed exactly what you did and it was pretty much all liquid. But during training swims, I did feel like, especially at the start, it's just sort of sitting on top and there's a bit of kind of almost throwing up in your mouth being done because it just isn't being absorbed quick enough until you're sort of almost, your stomach's emptied a bit. But I definitely found like oats. I felt like I needed something else, so I used oats, blended oats, put some dates in, some honey, some cinnamon, you know, almost like a posh liquid porridge, and that definitely sat really well. Not just the carb, the nasty carb liquid.
Nutrition for this kind of thing is so individual and it's so personal. I've told probably 50 people about what I put in my bottle, and it's probably only a handful of people that have taken that on and are using that solely as what they feed on. The important thing is that you find something that works for you. It's got enough nutrition, it's got enough calories, and you can take it on without feeling sick.
So, Nick, you've actually sort of done the equivalent of a channel swim. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that, and then also what you ate in that?
Well, it's funny, Tom was mentioned about the challenges of the Bristol Channel. I'm tempted 5 times and for different reasons, COVID being a big reason for that, weather being another. Yeah, so I've had to do the equivalent in a lake and just going across and horizontally instead of going across the channel, which was really frustrating. So yeah, for me, the main reason I swim is to eat, really. It's just a floating buffet. No way could I do the just liquids, so I just eat all the time. Love smoothies, similar to yours. And then I think I'd love to infiltrate your supply, Tom, that you've got on the boat. Now I know that that's there, that is not safe. I'll be after that. But yeah, go-to for me, dates, bananas, but brownie, anything really. I just eat anything really when I'm doing it.
But you're also playing that down a little bit, that you basically were lined up to do the channel, had it all booked in, did all the training, tons of work, and then you got blown out by the weather, but you'd also raised a lot of money for charity, hadn't you?
Yeah, I mean, it really frustrating in that we were all ready to go and then being told that it wasn't going to happen. There's COVID. So we actually had to do it in the lake, which in some ways was mentally horrible. Just doing laps of the lake. I didn't really think about that. Obviously, on the day, we'd never really practiced in that lake. And after about the 20th lap, I just thought, this is going to be the longest day ever. So I think it did about 11 hours of just continuous laps.
Was it 11 hours?
I think so, yeah.
Jesus.
So, yeah. I think we worked out the anyone that knows me knows my maths is horrendous. I did a garden marathon and ended up doing 36 miles instead of 26.
So, did you get out to eat at the lake? This was at Canada Lake,
yeah,
by
Canada
the way,
Lakes.
In Craiga,
yeah.
In Cardiff.
Oh, yeah. That's a duck pond. Come on.
But it has got a really dodgy, like, plug hole bit. And I'd always swim around that, just so scared I was going to get sucked out into that.
And a lot of big carp some pike.
A lot of nibbles throughout the day. Oh, God, what is that? But it was really mentally challenging in that it wasn't much to see. And I'm really interested. Some of your swims are, your longest one is 16 or 17 hours, was it?
My English Channel solo was the longest swim that I've ever done so far. That was 15 and a half hours. I got caught on, it was one of the biggest spring tides. I'll get the excuses in there. It was one of the biggest spring tides of the year, and it got quite rough in places. So my track is 21 miles straight line across. My track was 44 miles long that day. So it kind of shows you how far you get pushed by the tide.
I've seen the line of the world's fastest crossing, and it's a straight line across the English Channel, which is pretty incredible. It looks like a speedboat.
Yeah, so a guy broke that record this year. He did something like 6 hours 45. It was horrific, the speed that he got across there, but it's literally a dead straight line. And on the other end of that spectrum, you've got a 29-hour crossing, which, you know, the tide turns every 6 hours, and it is just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth all the way.
So that, tell us about that swimmer, actually, just briefly. Didn't she do, what was her name? And then did she also did a session with you prior to that, like a swim camp, didn't she, to get her qualifier? Is that right?
Yeah, so her name's Sophie Etheridge, and she was raising money. She's a disabled swimmer. So she was raising money for her charity and trying to highlight her disability. And she ended up, she came down to South Wales in June, and she did a 6 hour with me, and she did a bunch of other swims as well, smashed it for a good long weekend. And then her channel swim, yeah, absolutely mind blowing, 29 hours. I honestly don't know if I could do that, if I could stay in the water for that long. It was phenomenal effort that she put in, absolutely incredible.
And again, skins, no wetsuit, not touching boats.
I like how we're more interested in the longest time spent rather than the quickest.
To be honest, it's a much more impressive achievement. And, you know, the guy that went across in the record time, he's probably an Olympic standard swimmer.
Yeah, but boring.
You know, exactly. For him, it was probably a walk in the park.
Sorry if you're listening to this. We are impressed.
We are not worthy.
That's also brings up another real pitfall of channel swimming is weather and your dependency on weather. You know, you put so much time into training, you have a date in the diary. Okay, the English Channel, you kind of get a window, and probably we don't really operate like that just yet in the Bristol Channel, so you tend to get a date which is or isn't flexible. But yeah, it's a real problem. You've been thwarted a few times by weather windows, haven't you? So yeah, why don't you explain a little bit about what you've been trying to achieve over the last couple of years with the Bristol Channel in particular, and then maybe how you deal with the frustration of getting knocked back by Mother Nature.
So firstly, if I explain the English Channel then, what happens in the English Channel is you book your date, and generally the pilots for the English Channel, all of their business is taking swimmers. So from the start of June to the end of September, the only people that they'll book for their boat are channel swimmers. They tend to book four people for a tide. So a tide is like 7 days, you know, a week. If you book number one slot, then on Monday, if the weather's good, you're swimming. If the weather's good on Tuesday, swimmer number two swimming. Wednesday, number three goes. If the weather's bad, everybody gets bumped back a day. So number one will be swimming on Tuesday, number two will be swimming on Wednesday, which is all fine, unless you go past sort of Wednesday, and then swimmer number four has got nowhere to go. And they get bumped onto the reserve list as swimmer five, effectively, for the following week. And if you go outside your window, it does start getting messy with logistics and your swim crew, who are all taking time off work to come and help you out. Luckily, in the English Channel, I've always gone in my window so far, so I've pretty much been pretty lucky there, to be honest. Now, Bristol Channel, as you kind of alluded to, Bryce, a lot of the guys that have been taking swimmers, their core business is kind of doing RYA training courses and powerboat courses and other work that they have to book into the calendar, and they have to do it on that day. They can't just say, oh, look, I'm not going because the weather's bad. So the channel swimming thing was a bit of a difficult one for them to get their heads around, really. You're kind of phoning them up and saying, well, I want to go on this day, but I also need the next day and the next day and the next day free just in case. So keep your calendar clear. And if none of those days are good, then I kind of want to go the next week. And all of a sudden, you're looking at booking, you know, 2 weeks of their time, which just makes it completely no-go on the financial side of things. So what they tended to do is go, right, this is your date, 1st of July. If the weather's bad, then we'll just try and fit you in somewhere else where we've got a bit of space in the season. And anyone that knows what the British weather's like, it's a real difficult one to pick a date, you know, a year in advance. The weather could literally be doing anything. It's one of those things with channel swimming. You don't really want to be going out if the wind is stronger than probably a force three, which is a reasonably gentle breeze. Ideally, you know, you want high pressure mill pond conditions, perfectly flat water, and fly across. But Mother Nature doesn't really work that way.
I kind of think it's nice to have a bit of lump, to be honest. Like it needs to be swimmable, but like if it's a flat mill pond, it's a bit disappointing. It's kind of like, actually, you need a little bit of bounce, or at least a bit of a kind of up and down throughout the day, you know, a bit of calm, a bit of rough. Kind of keeps you on your toes, doesn't it?
It definitely makes it a lot more interesting for the swimmer, and depending who you've got on the boat crewing for you, they're probably going to enjoy it less. So my English channel, there was quite a bit of swell coming through, and I was enjoying it, you know, swimming up one side, down the other. The boat was rolling and rocking and rolling next to me. And I'm kind of swimming along, looking at the boat, thinking, well, where are all my crew? And it kind of dawned on me a couple of hours in that as the boat rolled, I could see them all being sick over the other side of the boat, and they were trying to hide it from me, but I could see them in the swell.
What about your failed attempts? Like, there's quite a significant kind of swim, I think, you've been trying to get under the belt for a while, but pretty much the weather's thwarted you most of the time, hasn't it?
The one Bristol Channel swim that I haven't yet ticked off is Ilfracombe to Swansea, which is 25 miles. It's bigger than the English Channel. Only four people have done it as a solo so far. And I've been trying to get that swim ticked off since 2020, I think. Every time something's come up, the weather's not been right. I've lost my boat. I've lost the pilot. I've lost my swim crew. Last year I was in a good position, or the year before even, I was in a really good position. I was ready to go. Didn't happen because of the weather. The year before that, my window got blown out, so I got moved backwards. I managed to organize another window with the pilot, but I started a new job on the Friday. And I really couldn't phone my new boss and say, you know, I'm supposed to be starting. Well, how's about if I just book a week off work? I went and sat in an office whilst the weather outside was absolutely perfect. And that was actually swimmer three and swimmer four that completed that route. They went on that window and they had the absolute dream conditions, mill pond, flat calm, dolphin escort all the way.
Oh, wow.
And I was just sitting there kicking myself. So last year, I was supposed to be going again for that one last year. Blown out my window again. Managed to organise another date for it. Thought everything was on. We'd arranged for the boat to go to Ilfracombe. We'd arranged for a car to drive round, refuel the boat, get all the stuff on the boat, all the people to come round, help crew for me. And then the pilot phoned me up the night before. He'd broken his knee and he couldn't spend more than half an hour on the boat. He was just in absolute agony.
Mind you, in that same year, I think you mentioned a few years ago now, you did three crossings in one year. So what were the crossings? Could you just clarify what were the crossings you did?
So Bristol Channel, since 1928, I think, was the first crossing. People have always swum Penarth to Weston, Penarth to Clevedon. That's a real recent one, really, last sort of 20 or 30 years. They've done Porthcawl to Glenthorne, and they've done Swansea to Ilfracombe. So there was kind of four routes. Now, they increase in distance from 9 miles to 12 miles to 16 miles to 25 miles for the biggest one. And I was kind of sat there thinking, well, if you had four perfect days that were spaced nicely apart throughout the season from sort of June to September, you could tick those off. And one would lead nicely as a training swim into the next, nicely into a training swim into the next, nicely into a training swim for the big one. And I got talking to a guy with a boat, and it all kind of started to come together. And I decided to go for it. So the first one was Penarth to Weston. And nobody had actually done that one since, I think, the 1960s in a pair of Speedos and have it ratified. And after I did it, I understood why, because the tide there is just horrific. It is the shortest Bristol Channel, but it's one of the most difficult ones to do. I think that was about, I want to say, 6.5 hours. A couple of weeks later, I did Penarth to Clevedon, which is 12 miles. Now, usually on that one, after the tide turns, so about halfway across, the wind and the tide is all going the same way and it flattens out and you get a huge push up channel. It's quite a nice swim. I did quite enjoy that one. Can't remember what the time was, 6:40 maybe, something like that. And then I attempted to swim Glenthorne to Porthcawl a few weeks later, which is 16 miles. And that swim, it's a hundred, well, it's not 100%, it's 90% down to the pilot getting you in the right place to catch the push of the tide up to Porthcawl. And if you miss that push, you know, on a spring tide, you'd have a 5-knot tide coming straight in your face. So you'd literally be going backwards for 6 hours. And unfortunately, on that first attempt, we got the pilot in slightly wrong. 8 hours into the swim, it was fairly obvious that, you know, I was going to be treading water for the next 6 hours. So I decided to get out on that one. We did. So that was kind of swim three, but it was a DNF. And then the swim four that I had booked in, that was originally going to be Swansea to Ilfracombe, but because I hadn't finished the Porthcawl Glenthorne one, that was kind of grinding at me. And we decided to attempt that one again, but this time swimming from Porthcawl to Devon. And I managed to get that one done in, it was just about 12 hours, I think. But by that stage of the season, we were right towards the end of the season, and it wasn't really feasible to give the monster long one a go after that.
So what are you thinking about in those 12 hours? What, any strategies and games, and how'd you get through those 12 hours?
When it's all going right, it's all going right, and everything's good, everything's happy, your head's happy. It's literally one feed to the next. So you're not trying to swim, you know, whatever it's going to be, 12 hours, 14 hours, 15 hours. You're trying to swim for 45 minutes. And when it does get difficult, you can bring that gap down. You know, you can ask the boat, say, look, I want to change to a 30-minute feed. So when everything's going well, that's fine. You're thinking to yourself, right, I'm going to be on the beach by lunchtime. There's going to be, you know, a crowd of people. It's going to be amazing. We'll be back home for tea in the pub. When it starts getting difficult, when it gets lumpy, when they always say you should never look up when you're channel swimming. And when you look up and you think you've been swimming forever, and all of a sudden the land is so far away, it really does get demoralizing. And that's the point where you really need those strategies in your head. And the same as nutrition, it's going to be completely dependent on the person. What is your reason for doing it? Why are you staying in the water? You know, everything hurts, everything's tired. There's an easy way out. You just get on the ladder that's literally 5 foot away from you, and it all finishes, everything goes away. Or you stay in there and you carry on turning your arms over. The last swim that I did across the Bristol Channel, it got a bit lumpy in places and I wasn't enjoying myself. And I looked up and we were so far away from shore. And at that point, I was having such a battle in my own head as to, do I take the ladder? Do I get out? And on that swim, I remember thinking to myself, well, you can get out, but then you're going to have to do it again in a couple of weeks to prove that you can do it. And you're going to have to put another 8, 9, 10 hours in just to get to this point. So you might as well just stay in and suffer through it, you know?
Did you make it?
Yeah. As soon as you get there, all of that suffering goes away.
Yeah. One of the things I think I found with that as well was the Penarth Clevedon swim that we, I think it was 2020, we booked it and it was quite late in the season. So I think it was maybe the end of September. I can't remember what it was. So obviously you're putting your eggs in that basket towards the end of the season, and spent all that time, you know, training, did all my training in the sea, so I didn't do anything in the pool. But what that meant was it was time away from, you know, family. I went on holiday to Scotland and spent literally in a van traveling around Scotland for about 6 weeks, or what, I can't remember how long it was, but maybe a month, with the family. And every other day it was like literally just looking on maps, finding big bodies of water, big lochs, saying, okay, I need to swim, you know, at least 2 hours, at least, you know, if not more, every other day. So it kind of like dictated my holiday, which actually in Scotland driving around in a van is absolutely fine, you know, got us to some incredible beautiful places that you wouldn't go otherwise. But, you know, to a degree there, my family are taking the hit and sacrifice because of my drive and my goal. And then in Cardiff, or South Wales, wherever we were swimming. Again, every other day, putting the mileage up. And when it got closer, doing sort of 3-4 hour training swims, you know, Nick helped a lot and kind of volunteered his time to practice, help me practice feeds. So I was doing, I think we did like a 4.5 hour or four and a quarter hour swim from Fontagary to Jackson's Bay and back. And it was he came on a paddle board and just paddled it for 4 hours.
That's passing never good us at food, giving you know. The food that always sink your feet.
Yeah, but Nick sacrificed his time for us, you know, and basically so many people are affected by your decision to and so many people kind of support you in that. So, you know, you're also you're booking in somebody to be an observer for a whole day on a boat, if not more, you know, 12 hours on a boat. That's not including the time it takes to get on the boat, drive to the boat, get your gear, all that sort of stuff. So when the window came up and then we got blown out at the start, so we've got the first date got blown out, so you had to wait 2 weeks, and then it was October the 13th, 14th, something like that. So it's end of the season, it's getting cold. The weather was borderline. It was like, well, the boatman was saying, I don't think you should go. He's trying to blow it off till like June the next year. And in my head, I'm like, well, so many people have sacrificed their time and I've put all this year's kind of worth of effort in. It's like, I'd rather go and fail and do my best for the sake of not just myself, but everyone else who's kind of, you know, put the effort in. It's a lot on your shoulders, isn't it? You know, when you decide to pull the plug on something, and a lot that gets you across if you dig for it.
100%. And whatever sport you do, you know, if it's running, if it's triathlon, if it's swimming, when you start stepping up to these silly, silly distances, you need 100% commitment. You need to be training. You need to be putting the hours in. There's no shortcuts. You know, you can't just jump in having not swum for 10 years and go and do a 12-hour swim. Exactly the same as you couldn't really jump in and just go and run a marathon, you know. You have to put that training time in. You have to make those sacrifices. There's so many times where, you know, you don't want to go training. You don't want to go and swim in the sea. You don't want to go early morning and swim in the pool. But you've got to do it. And exactly what you said with family, it's such a big commitment, not just for you, but everybody else that's in your life. They're all making sacrifices so you can go and do that. And yeah, you do need to be mindful of the pressure that you're putting yourself under, really, because nobody's forcing you to do this. It's your goal. It's your desire. It's, at the end of the day, the question is, how much do you want it? Do you want to stay in or do you want to get out? That's all a marathon swim boils down to at the end of the day.
And you can train for that physically as much as possible, but it's mental strength that gets you across. You know, I mean, I can say it now, it's a couple of years down, but, and I didn't actually know for sure until after the swim, but I did it with COVID. And I hadn't slept for about 48 hours before the swim. And I was in bits. I was really ill. I was not happy, but I was like, I don't want to miss this opportunity because of all these people around me that I would just feel like such a dick if I just didn't try. And I'd rather get pulled out of the water than fail than not get in. And it's definitely that mental strength that kind of, I think, made that happen. But
you had COVID, you super spreader, taking it over to
England. I didn't get in the boat. Like, I swam across. I didn't touch anyone. And I didn't, I actually tested positive the day after. So I didn't know, you know, I thought it was just a fluke. But yeah, it was.
I remember I lent you my Garmin and I saw you a few days before and I was just like, yeah, I'll put that on the car and just leave it there. Near me.
Tom, you mentioned earlier about, you know, really important to have that why. Can we ask, could you share, what's your why? Why do you do this?
I honestly can't tell you that. I'm not sure I figured it out, if I'm honest. When I did the English Channel, that's such a long build-up and it's so expensive. You know, English Channel, you're talking sort of 2-3 year wait to sign up for that one, just because the boats are solidly booked out and it is a good £3,500 a swim. So you're talking a phenomenal amount of money. And when I first signed up to the English Channel, I didn't know anything about channel surfing. I just thought, oh, it's just one of these things that people do. I really had not Googled much. I didn't know much about it. I knew you had to wear Speedos, and I knew you weren't allowed to touch the boat, but that was pretty much all I knew about it. I was just like, oh, I know a load of people that have done it now. I'm sure I can do it. It'll be fine. So the build-up to that one, it's such a big thing, and there was so much pressure on it. I'd kind of been thinking about it and playing the scenarios out in my head for like 2-3 years. And not once on that swim did I think, I'm not going to make this. The last 3 miles, I think, it really did get horrible. And it took me something like 4 hours to make the last 3 miles in. And I was just getting completely flattened by the waves left, right, and center. But even through that, I think I built it up in my head as such a do or die effort. There was no option for getting out. There was no option for you're going to get out on the boat and the swim's going to finish here. It just wasn't even an option.
Yeah, and it's quite a machine. The English Channel process is a machine, isn't it? It's like, it's built to make money, really, let's face it.
There's a big demand for the English Channel. I think there's something like 2,500 people now that have done solo swims.
Yeah.
And they always call it sort of the Everest of open water swimming. And I think to somebody who's not been in and around channel swimming circles, then perhaps that's how you see it. But you don't realize there's all of these other channels, like the Bristol Channel, like the North Channel, that you could go and do that only a handful of people have done.
Mm.
And in quite a few of those examples, they're actually harder than the English Channel. It's certainly a more difficult route to do it. But because there is so many people and there's so much history in the English Channel, quite a lot of people, they're just like, yeah, that's the one that I need to do. That's the one I want to tick off.
So it's quite an exciting time, isn't it? Because it's like really young right now. Like Bristol Channel is those records are yet to be set. That history is yet to be written. I mean, there's obviously a strong history already, but it can be built on. And we've got a relationship with the Bristol Channel because we look at it every day. So it's kind of makes more sense to like forge those paths here, doesn't it?
Yeah, 100%. And the other beautiful thing about the Bristol Channel is it goes from, let's say, 9 miles wide by Western Supermare to 25 miles wide by Swansea. So if you're the sort of person that thinks, right, I couldn't do a 25-mile swim, well, there's a 9-mile swim there, which is, you know, it's less than half of the English Channel. Quite a lot of people, they'll do relays in the English Channel, but they'll never attempt a solo because of the cost, because of the distance. You know, it's too hard in their head. They can't see how they would do it. But all of a sudden, if you drop that to a 6-hour swim, 9 miles distance, then that's doable.
Mm.
And it's still a channel swim. You're still swimming one side to the other. You're still swimming Wales to England or England to Wales. And there's only a handful of people that have done that swim.
Tom, can you tell us a bit about your world record? Because I really like your badge on your swim rope.
I said Bristol Channel, it was first swum in 1928, I think. And up until about 2015, only about 25 people had ever swum it. After 2015, sort of 2019, 2020 really was when we first started seeing people. 2022, 2023, 20 people, 25 people a year after that. And we were getting all different people coming from all over the world. And they're saying, I'm the oldest person. I'm, you know, the youngest person. I'm the first person to have done this route. I'm the first person to have done breaststroke. They were claiming all these different firsts. And English Channel, there was a whole bunch of different Guinness World Records. People know fastest crossing, slowest crossing. They know all the people that have swum butterfly and backstroke and all these weird and wonderful different swims. Now, in the Bristol Channel, because there was no association and all of these swims had basically been done off people's backs and then they're sending all the information off to be ratified by, you know, bodies in America and all different associations around the world, Guinness World Records had never looked at the Bristol Channel and said, right, you can be fastest, you can be oldest, So there was no official world records for the Bristol Channel. When we founded Bristol Channel Association, obviously all that changed, because now there's a local body that's sort of looking after the swims, making sure everything is well and truly above board and to the rules, if you want. And all of a sudden, Guinness were like, well, we're getting all these applications for these different people. So how do we go about putting in place records? And we kind of said to them, well, let's look at the English Channel. We'll take the most popular ones, the most sort of well-known ones that they've got, I guess, which is, you know, oldest, fastest, most, and we'll create Guinness World Records for those. So we now have male and female, oldest, fastest. We have records for the original Triple Crown, which is the Bristol Channel, the English Channel, and the North Channel. And there really is only a handful of swimmers that have done all three of those. And I was given the Guinness World Record for most Bristol Channels. So that was originally when they sort of created the record. It was 5 and now it's 6. And it's still a work in progress. Hoping to get a few more this year.
So you kind of carved yourself out a little record during your negotiations and discussions with the Guinness.
Well,
let me clear my throat. So to get those records, just for a clarification, do they need to be ratified under channel swimming rules?
Yes.
Which yep. Also, so talking on that, how much do you care about ratification? Obviously, for your records to stand, that's quite important. But as far as the ratification process goes, how important do you think that is to channel swimming?
Originally, right, when we started looking at a Bristol Channel Association, I was not at all interested. I didn't want to be involved with the politics. I didn't want anything to do with that side of it. And the first few swims that I did in the Bristol Channel, I tried to get them ratified by a body in America who had done ratifications before in the Bristol Channel. And you have to put a whole document pack together with photos and videos, and you have to have an observer write a report, and they have to keep a log with, you know, wind speed and water temperature every hour of the swim. You have to send coordinates where you are every hour. You have to send the GPS files. And it's all to prove that the swim is 100% above board. It's to the rules. It's been done in accordance to the rules. There's nothing to hide. It's all there. Been around marathon swimming now for quite a few years. Unfortunately, I guess it's the same as any sport. There's people claiming things and people saying that they've done things that when you start digging into it, it's fairly obvious that they haven't done what they're saying. And perhaps, you know, they didn't quite keep to the rules here and they didn't quite do that there. Does it matter? Maybe not. It's one of those things, isn't it, that I think for me, I want to do it properly and I want all the evidence there and I want everybody to see that it's been done properly and there's no questions. For another swimmer, that might not matter at all to them. They might just want to say, right, I've done it. I know what I've done. That's fine.
I think it all comes down to what you claim, doesn't it? And like that all basically boils down to doing something in good style or not. So you can do something in good style, whether it's in a wetsuit or not in a wetsuit, whatever. It's just how you put across or how you claim what you did. I think that's the important bit really, isn't it?
100%. Yeah. A lot of these rules for channel swimming, they're completely arbitrary. Somebody's decided that that is the rules. If you don't want to stick to that and it doesn't matter to you, then crack on, do whatever you want.
Well, let's face it, Tom, you didn't wear wool and you didn't drink Bovril, so to be honest,
100% true.
You know, I don't think you're doing it quite in in the right style.
The other thing that all the purists never mention is back in the day they had sort of a rowing boat escorting them across the channel.
Yeah.
There's no GPS.
Yeah.
There's no radar. There was no sort of computer guidance. Whereas if you get on a boat these days, you've got, you know, a state-of-the-art boat next to you. It's got GPS,
yeah.
GLONASS, it's got a plotter this big. You can see which way the tides are going from the plotter. You can calculate everything from there, basically.
And you've got an observer advising you on stroke rate and stuff like that as well, potentially. I mean, I don't know what the rules are about that, but I guess it's not much different to wearing a Garmin in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Your crew on the boat can tell you, you know, you're perfectly fine to ask them any question you want. Obviously, you know, stopping for a chat does take up time. They can say, right, your stroke needs a bit of work. You need to up your stroke rate. You need to kick harder. Is that outside assistance?
Yes. Well, it's aid. To some degree, it's aid, isn't it? Yeah, it's an interesting topic, you know, because these things are all just made up by someone, you know. And like you said, you were contacting someone in America to ratify something in South Wales. You know, that person doesn't even have to have ever set foot in South Wales, you know, and who's to say they make the rules?
I don't think any one of those people had seen the Bristol Channel or probably even heard of it before I sent my swims in. It's an interesting one that you said about the swim costumes, because, yeah, that is a very good point. The original kind of, you know, 1875, it was basically a knitted woolen costume. There are rules in the Channel Swimming sort of rule book about technical swimsuits. So some of these super hydrodynamic costumes that you might see people wearing in the Olympics, they wouldn't be allowed under certain rules of channel swimming. And again, it's about gaining an advantage. But where do you draw the line on that one? You know, it's such a grey area.
Yeah, there's a big topic of conversation doing the rounds on the NIAID film, you know. And I've watched it, and a lot of people really enjoy the film, especially people who aren't in the channel swimming world or whatever, just, you know, want to watch a good flick. And then the gatekeepers, there's a lot of gatekeepers out there kind of doing their best to discredit it and really put a smear over the whole film, you know. I mean, the film's just a story essentially, but I get that it's kind of presented as a true story, and most of it is really. It's a tough one, isn't it? Because I mean, I don't really care that much, to be honest, personally. I'm not that bothered. I think it's all, you know, it is, I get why it's important, but at the same time, I don't really care too much. And you can't really take away what that person did, you know, the achievement that she made with the NIAID film. But yeah, at the same time, a lot of people really hate her. Really, really hate her.
I think it goes back to exactly what you said earlier a bit about it's how you present what you've done. The controversy with the NIAID film is she said that it was completely unassisted, one island to the other. And then there's a lot of holes in the... Well, if the critics are to be believed, there's a lot of holes in the observer report. There's a lot of question marks. There's a lot of hours that are missing from the log. And then there's another few things in there that could or couldn't be deemed as assistance. So it's how you present it, really. If she'd just come out in the first place and said, well, I've done this and I've done this and I had a little bit of assistance here, but I've essentially still swum whatever it was, 100 miles, I think a lot of that divisiveness would have gone away.
I'm amazed by this. So have you ever had with the Bristol Channel Swimming Association just someone trying to completely blag it? Can you share any stories of that you can just tell that is rubbish?
So the first swim that I did, Wales Online put an article on their Facebook, and you know, there's a load of pictures and there's a load of stuff about crazy guys from the Bristol Channel. And literally the first comment on there was, oh, but my mate did that last week. And I'm just like, all right, then, let's see some pictures. We have had a couple of swims that have a little bit of controversy around them. There was a swim a couple of years ago where the guy claimed to have done it. But I say there's all this sort of evidence that needs to be submitted at the moment to say, yeah, swim's good and it's all above board. And almost all of that was missing. So all we've got basically is a couple of photos of him in the water in a pair of Speedos.
I might try it.
Tell where the water is, you know. It's like, well, did you swim it or didn't you? You might have done. I really can't say from what you've given us.
It's got Barry Island chip shop in the background.
Him with his budgies.
We actually share a kind of made up, not 100% record, don't we? The three of us.
100%.
Yeah, that's like,
hang on, record. There's a plaque. I think it's got to be true.
We've actually got plaques that Nick's dad made for us. I've got a plaque to give to you. And that swim was on the 16th of March, 23, and it was the first official crossing from Lavernock to Flatholm, wasn't it? A winter swim, not ratified, I might like to add. We were in wetsuits. It was bloody nobbling. And it was my birthday.
Boots, gloves, everything.
And we swam from Flatholm across to... No, we swam from Lavernock Point to Flatholm for my birthday, stayed over on the island, got drunk, and did not swim back. We got the boat back, didn't we?
We really could have swum back. That would have been amazing.
but then we did... later on that year, we did actually... swim back as the first swimmers from Flatholm to Barry again that we know of.
And I did it. I had the dodgy ankle, so I did it with my crutches. You had to help me up.
Yeah,
I ruptured my Achilles. Oh yeah.
Yeah, there's photos of us helping Nick out of the water.
So really I could dodgy. Do, I can walk. So I might as well just swim.
Dodgy Flatholm rocks. big up Simon on the island, Simon the Warden.
If any listeners out there get the chance, go to Flatholm. It's so cool. It's got a pub, post office, and some good devil worshipping caves.
The most southerly Welsh pub. We had a good time, didn't we?
But if you're going to swim there, don't do it in March.
No, add it to the adventure, I think. Are we going to make
absolutely
it, or are we going to freeze?
Nobbling.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a good route plotted that day, to be fair. We did land bang on the button, didn't we? We had chances of completely missing it and ending up towards Bristol somewhere.
The tide absolutely charges past those islands. So, yeah, hitting a very small dart in a very big ocean is tricky.
Hey, we got to do Steepholme next, though, haven't we?
Oh, I'd love to do that. There's actually a couple of islands in the Bristol Channel. I think there's probably five or six decent ones. So I was thinking about it a few times that we should try and hit them all.
Make sure you include us in those plans because you know we're good for it.
When you're not spending your time for hours on end in budgies, you are doing a lot of charity work. You do a lot of volunteering, you do a lot of park run, a lot of community stuff. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
So a lot of the swims that go back to triathlon. A lot of the triathlons I did, I was kind of trying to use those to raise a bit of money for various charities that were close to my heart. The last couple of years, I've kind of discovered that companies, corporate things, have lots of money available that they like to give away because it makes them look good and it makes their tax bill look quite efficient. So the last few companies that I've worked for, we've really done our best to dig into their corporate giving pots and get as much money for we can as for the local community, really. The company I work for at the moment, it's been really good. They've given loads of money out to the local lifeguard clubs. At the moment, we're looking, there's an independent lifeboat station between the two Severn Bridges, and they're looking at a new launch tractor. So we've actually put that into the pot and said, look, can we fund a bit of their new tractor?
Oh, wow.
Obviously, that kind of thing, it's all for the local community, you know, basically. All the local lifeguard clubs feed all the kids with all that good knowledge about water safety and first aid skills. So the more money that we can pump into those, really, the better.
So I know that we've got to wrap this up pretty soon now because you're actually going to train with the lifeguards and try and stay on those young 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds' toes in the pool, which is admirable. You definitely won't catch me in there doing that. We're swimming tomorrow morning, though, aren't we? Yeah. In the cold Bristol Channel. Got a nice little two-way...
Hopefully no lifeguards, anyway.
January. Yeah, we're going to call the lifeguards and make sure they don't come out after us. But, you know, what have you got planned for the future? What's kind of coming up? Where have you got your sights set?
I've got some real exciting plans coming up. Bristol Channel, I really have to get that Swansea to Wilfred Coombe swim ticked off. I'm fairly confident that the plans I've put in place for this year are completely fallible. So at some point, that swim is definitely maybe going to happen. The rest of the season, it kind of needs to fit around that one, really. I've got loads of little swims that I've been thinking about, all these different islands, up and down the coast. I mean, you guys do so many of those, and they're so much fun. You know, when you've got a 5-knot spring tide behind you, your pace on Strava is like world record pace. It's incredible. Long term, I've just paid a deposit for a two-way English Channel for next year. So that's swim to France.
Wow.
Have 10 minutes on the beach, swim back. After that one, I don't know. That one really is a roll of the dice. Let's see what happens. Let's give it a crack and see how far we get.
How long for that one then, do you estimate?
I'd like to think, my first English Channel was 15 and a half hours, I think. So I'd like to think I'd be closer to 12 now. But that's completely down to the conditions and the day. Generally, people that have done two ways, and there's only a handful of those, say it's marginally easier with the tides on the way back. So double your 12 hours, you're looking at least 24.
Wow.
Get a bad day, it could be closer to 30. Get a really bad day, it could be longer than that.
Do you get to stop for Moulfreet halfway around?
You literally only get 10 minutes in France, and that's it.
Is that the rule?
Uh-huh.
Out of the water?
It depends where you land. If you land on the beach, you're allowed. If you land on a cliff, there's nowhere out. You literally just tumble, turn off the cliff and head back.
Gutted.
with the English Channel, the shortest distance lands you underneath a lighthouse, and there's a restaurant there. If you land on that slipway for the restaurant, they come out, they give you glasses of champagne. Everyone has a nice little word to you. Back on the boat, back home.
Oh, wow.
I think I've done 4 relays and a solo every time aiming for the restaurant. Right, this time I'm going to get a glass of champagne. The only time I've landed on that slipway was in the middle of COVID and everything was shut and there was nobody there.
Gutted. Oh, I think I'd probably throw up if I drank champagne after swimming that long anyway. Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for talking to us then, Tom. It's looking forward to catching up with you soon and getting a swim in.
Always a pleasure. March is fast approaching, so we better make some plans, had we?
Yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah, true. Birthday shenanigans. how do we actually finish an interview, Nick?
Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Swim Roots is a production brought to you by Swim Wild Wales and SWA, Swimmers with Attitude. Your hosts are me, Bryce Davis, and Nicholas Young. Additional production and original music by Tom Clugston. Visit swimwildwales.com for information on open water swim coaching, events and guiding, or follow us on social media to keep up to date with our open water swim expeditions and adventures. Thanks for listening.